How can we make the world better? By making ourselves better. The Dr. Joe Show explores how you can make positive personal change by using his groundbreaking and highly effective I Am approach to understand who we are and why we do what we do. Your small changes can have big effects.
Join us now for the Dr. Joe Show with Mark Stiles of Stiles Law and your host, Dr. Joe Schrand.
And welcome to the Dr. Joe Show.
Wow, that was nice. That
was different.
Yeah, it was different. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, cadence to it. And
yeah.
Down in the scale.
Yeah.
You have a lovely voice. Have you thought of singing?
Haha. So I haven't been trained how to sing. I have good stage presence, I'm told.
You do.
From your daughter.
And
people
something.
Say I have a good radio voice, so I keep doing this. I think it's fun.
I think it's fun.
It sounds nasally to me, but people say I have a nice radio voice. I have a face for radio too.
So you think it sounds nasally? I mean, who knows, right?
Good one.
Thanks.
Yeah. Sweet. Yeah.
How have you been doing?
Great. Got a lot of good feedback on last week's episode on the movie One Love, our rewatchable episode. I guess we got a lot of engagement there, and it was well received.
I'm so glad, because it was such an incredible show, and it was really, it stimulated in us all this discussion about the conflict that we have in the world and how can we manage all that stuff. And there's so much to it, and it's all in the news right now. It's in the news. And with that in mind, I wonder whether you could introduce our guest for tonight.
I absolutely will do that, Dr. Joe. Speaking of the news, this individual, this guest, this amazing human being, he's traveled the country with the circus and as a news reporter. He's been to the Soviet Union right after the wall came down. He's interviewed Dr. Joe. He taught Larry Bird how to juggle with three balls. Larry Bird. Yeah, that guy. He's been in San Francisco. KRON4. He's been on NESN. I'm sorry. New England Cable Network. CBS Providence. Fox Boston. ABC News. This guy's really impressive, and I can't wait to meet him. Please meet Steve Avison.
Yeah.
Whoa. Gosh, who is that person you introduced?
I don't know, but you taught Larry Bird how to juggle. Like, can we talk about that for a second?
Of course you can.
Let's go right into that.
Yeah.
So juggling's not that easy.
Oh, it is for Larry Bird. Are you kidding?
Yeah. So how did he not know how to do it before he met you?
Maybe he did.
Okay.
Maybe he did. But, back in 86, that was a stellar year for the Boston Celtics. And we had done stories working for WBZ TV Evening Magazine at the time. And we had done stories with Bill Walton. And we had done stories with, Kevin McHale. And this was now our story with Dennis Johnson. And so we go to the gym. We're hanging out during warm-ups and stuff. And my cameraman, who's, kind of an ambitious guy, he's called, did you hear what Larry Bird said about Dennis Johnson? I said, oh, you mean he's the best player that I ever played with, best teammate? And I said, of course I have. And he goes, well, you got to ask DJ. You got to get Larry Bird to say. I said, you don't go to Larry Bird and say, oh, Mr. Bird, would you please repeat that thing that you said to Dan Shaughnessy in the Boston Globe that it's with so nicely for our television thing? And so, we kind of put that aside. But DJ is playing along in a way. He knows that this is something that might be of merit to us. And after their practice, they're hanging around. Now, you guys know that the famous stories about Michael Jordan being a very competitive gambler. Well, he's not the only guy.
Yeah.
So DJ and Bird are doing a little, 30 years ahead of time, Steph Curry. They're shooting balls from half court. And they're playing a game for some money, and we'll talk about the amount. And whoever gets the most in consecutively, they're going to get the cash. It's $50, let's call it. And everyone's gone. And the DJ has given us some great B-roll. My cameraman's happy. I'm ecstatic. And I'm shagging balls. When they occasionally miss, which is a few times, I would grab the ball and toss it back to them. I'm making nice, right? And at some point, two in a row get missed. And so I grab one ball and I grab a second ball and they shoot a third one. I get the third ball and I take the third ball and I proceed to juggle it.
Nice.
Something I can do from juggling in Harvard Square as a kid making his way through college. And Larry Bird looks at me and he goes, "Well, what's it that?" I said, "Well, it's juggling. I can teach you how to juggle." "Huh. Well, give them to me." So I give him two balls and I'm thinking, this dude knows how to juggle already, doesn't he? And he goes, "What do I do now?" I said, "Well, I'm going to throw the ball up. And when it gets up there, you toss the other one under." And so I get closer to Larry Bird and I take the third ball and I toss it up in the air. He juggles it right away.
Nice.
Are you kidding me? He needed no guidance. You know, he juggles three balls for, you know, 20 seconds.
Love it.
Puts the balls down. He's done. The game's over. I don't know who won. I did not see money change hands.
Of course.
I suspect that Bird won, but DJ was very happy because he was doing okay that day. So that was me teaching Larry Bird how to juggle three balls.
That's awesome. What a great story.
It's great. And brings in your circus career. I assume that that's part of where you were learning how to juggle.
Yeah. Yeah. I traveled to circus when I was a kid. What a great mother. You know, you go home to mom and say, "Hey, mom, I'm thinking about, you know, just going off with the circus this summer." And mom goes, "Yeah, that's cool." I mean, she thought it was okay. And so while traveling, it was a small circus, three people and a few animals, all of whom were shelter creatures. They were not, you know, trained to do anything. They weren't deprived of a good life. They were given a good life because all of them didn't have a home. And this dude who ran the circus gave them a home. And I learned some stuff. So on that first visit with the circus back in a long time ago in the 1970s, someone taught me how to juggle. And then I learned how to ride a unicycle and walk a tightrope and eat fire and you name it.
How old were you traveling with the circus?
The first time I did it twice. And the first time was the summer and I did it when I was 17.
Yeah.
And then I went to college and I was at the University of California. And my roommate and I had this ambition after our sophomore year to transfer. We both transferred to Stanford. And he went to Stanford and I went with the circus again. Imagine calling your mom and say, "Hey, mom, guess what? You know, I mean, she knew about the Stanford thing. It was going to bring me closer to home, among other things." And I called him and said, "Hey, mom, guess what? I'm going to go to the circus, but this time it's for a whole year and it's on the road and I get paid no money, but it's going to be fun." And she said, "Oh, so Stephen, does that mean that you're not going to go to Stanford?" I said, "Yeah, well, I mean, I might go someday, but I mean, right now I'm going to travel with the circus." And she said, "Oh, well that's really great." That's it. She was awesomely supportive.
Wow.
So it was great. And that ultimately brought me to the East Coast and Dr. Joe eventually, because of course you come to the East Coast and, you know, I'm here starting a Shakespeare company in Boston with some friends and you meet a girl and all of a sudden you phone your mom, "Hey mom, I won't be coming home for Christmas because, you know, I met a girl and I'm hanging out here and here I am all these many years later."
And with that in mind, how did you get into the news business and the reporting and everything that you've been doing? I mean, you've gone all over the world with this.
Yeah, I am, you know, performing as a late teenager in early 20s, making a few bucks to pay for college. People came and did stories about me from the different television stations. And the said girl, I went to Europe and performed on the streets in Europe, you know, went performed everywhere, Paris and Berlin and various other places when I was whatever year. And when I came back, I said, "Well, I've done everything and now it's time for me to leave Boston and move to New York or Los Angeles and do important things." And she said, "Oh, but I mean, you don't want to leave Boston." And I said, "Well, yeah, I kind of do. I mean, I got to do, well, but you haven't done everything." And I said, "Well, I've done all the theater and everything else." And she goes, "Well, what about television?" I said, "Television? Oh, that's so dirty. Why would I want to do that?" And she said, "Well, you've been on television. There was nice people over at Channel 5, WCVB, did a story about you. You got to call that nice guy who did the story." And, you know, she persuaded me to do so. And I did. And he said, "Oh, hey, Steve, you're in wow. Hey, how would you like to interview a guy on a tugboat?" And I said, "Well, okay." And I rode my bike down from Beacon Hill to the Museum of Science at Charles River. And there's a guy in a tugboat at the end of this show called the Good Day Show. I had like 4 or 5 minutes, never done this before, to interview a tugboat captain. I pulled the horn and talked to the guy, and he laughed, and I made him laugh, and he made me laugh. And it was a great conversation at the end of the show. And they end the show, and that's it. And back to the studio, and I get on my bike, and I'm heading back to, you know, to home, and the girlfriend calls me up. She said, "Hey, that was really great. You did a great job. It was live. Nobody does live like that. It was really great." And I said, she said, "Was it fun?" I said, "Yeah, but yeah." And I tried to help them take down the lights, and they wouldn't let me do that. She said, "Why?" I said, "Oh, well, because it's a union shop." And I said, "That doesn't seem like much fun. I mean, shouldn't we all work together?" You know, and so she, "We got to phone him and thank him." Well, I didn't. And she, next day she called me, said, "Did you phone him and thank him?" I said, "I hadn't done that yet." And the third day, the phone rings in my apartment. I said, "Oh my God, she's calling me. I haven't phoned him yet." And that day, the mail arrived. And in the mail was an envelope from WCVB-TV, and it was a check. And the check was for $150. And I called him so fast. And he said, "Hey, did you have fun?" I said, "Yeah." "You want to do it again?" I said, "Oh, yeah, that'd be great." Anyway, that was the beginning. I did stuff there. And then I went to work for Evening Magazine. And, you know, one thing leads to the other, you know. People see you and they say, "Oh, how would you like to do this?" And so I said, "Yeah, I'll do that."
Yeah. It's an incredible story. It's wonderful for people to hear, because do what you love. We're going to have a guest, maybe we already did already, who said, no need to compete with other people. Just do what you love. Only you can do it. And it sounds like that's part of what you were doing, Steve. It's like just doing what you love.
Yeah, you hear people say that. And it's hard, because sometimes what you love doesn't pay the bills. And you got to, you could do something else. I'm reading a book about Marie Yovanovitch. She was the person who was a State Department person for Ukraine, or for the United States to Ukraine. And there's some compromises that occurred during her tenure. She was fired by the Trump administration, and then she ended up testifying during an impeachment trial. And she talks about, you know, wanting to do certain things, but not getting to do it. No matter how much she loved it, she didn't get the gig. And, but she would always have her black apron so that she could wait table and earn enough money until she could do what she wanted to do. And, in her book, this very accomplished, State Department person, she says, "I still got my black apron in the bureau," because you do what you have to do to make a buck, and yet find a way to do the things you love with as much of your time as you can, I guess.
Yeah. And I do think that's one of my definitions of success, is when you love going to work and love going home, you know, because then it doesn't feel like work. And right. I think that's really part of what our sponsors are like as well. I mean, they love doing what they're doing, and we love the fact that they support us in the Dr. Joe Show. So with that in mind, we'll take a commercial break. We'll be right back with the Dr. Joe Show and Steve Avison.
Hey, folks, thank you for listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We've been investigating whether or not we want to bring sponsors into our podcast. What are your thoughts? Do you know somebody who might be a good partner with the Dr. Joe Show, who may want to align their product or service with the Dr. Joe Show? Think about it. And we're back with the Dr. Joe Show with Steve Avison, man of many stories. And what a storyteller he is. Dr. Joe, how did you meet Steve?
You know, it was just one of those wonderful things. At the time, I was medical director over at High Point Treatment Center, and I was promoting, I can't remember which book, my first or second book. And Steve, do you want to take it from there, what you remember and how it all came about?
Well, I worked at New England Cable News, and they had invited me to come and help start a program there called The Morning Show. It was a great wide-ranging opportunity to talk about the news of the day, but also to go a little deeper on different topics. And you were a terrific guest.
Thank you.
And I think we're always trying to populate I mean, we may have agendas, we may have ideas, we may have topics that we want to pursue and cover and inform people about. You don't want someone who drones on or someone who's just self-promoting or someone who's dull. And Dr. Joe is a great listener and a great informer. And so we had that first conversation and, it was about something you were interested in advocating for people. And then subsequently, when we would have our bull sessions in our team backstage preparing for the next day, and I said, oh, we can get Dr. Joe. I mean, he could talk about that. And then there'd be the next conversation, I mean, if there's a school, I remember we talked, Dr. Joe, you talked about just about everything. Yeah. Depression, school shootings, single parenting, all sorts of topics. And the statement, it got to be a go-to. I said, I think Dr. Joe could do this. And then after that, I'm hearing, like young producers say, oh, we got to get Dr. Joe. He's really good. Once it was established, it was gone. You were off and running.
And it was so much fun. And it would, a lot of interviews, I was so honored, but it was in studio it was in Needham, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And very often the show would be about 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:30, sometimes a little earlier. And it was great because I would miss traffic, but it was still 45 minutes up there and then about an hour and a half back in traffic. But it was so much fun. I loved every moment of it. And I got to meet Steve. And we just really connected. I mean, it wasn't just on the show. And I'm very proud to say, Steve, I hope you don't mind me saying that Steve is one of my board members for Drug Story Theater.
Oh, cool.
And I could not be more honored because he brings so much of this community to it and how we can have more visibility. And I mean, that's what board members do, is they help advance us. And so I was so honored when Steve said he was willing to do that, and even more honored that he here on the show talking about all these wonderful things. I mean, Steve, you've influenced so many people, way more than any of us will ever know, millions of people.
Well, as I've heard you guys say in the past, we're just talking to trees here until you discover that there's one of those trees came to life. It's a person. Ooh, they actually listened and remembered and maybe took action. I think not to toot your horn too much, but Drug Story Theater, it hits on so many different levels. There's the ultimate performance level where an audience hears authentic stories and are moved to be informed or to understand. But obviously the process of bringing something to stage, a little different than just actors. I mean, these are people who are telling stories that are real and that are important. And there's a kind of, I feel catharsis for them to be able to, be given respect and an opportunity and a platform to let the world know, hey, I'm here. I've been through a journey and thank you for listening to me talk about my journey and bring it to life a little bit. And for parents and everything else, it's huge, really, really righteous. I'm very proud of what you do.
Honestly. I appreciate that. And it is it's powerful for these kids. And we both have been performers, so we know what that's like to be in front of an audience. You perform and then you get that round of applause, and it is the greatest rush. It's all oxytocin. It's this massive release of saying, we so appreciate you, we respect you, we value you, thank you. And when our kids who are, in the throes of early stages of recovery, when they get that experience, they never knew it. We're working on a show now that one of our graduates has written, Heather, who's now an intern with us, has been with us for years, on Narcan. And we're going to be performing that within the next couple of months, and we'll let you know about it. Awesome. But what's lovely is we've got three of our kids who've been with us for years. They show up. They want to be there. They want to be back on stage. Melvin was saying, "I can't wait to be back on stage. I love that feeling." So it's really great. Well, what's it like for you, Steve? I mean, starting with circus. I mean, what is that experience like for you, being the person who others are focusing on and offering that information that you do?
I guess there's a huge difference between, the audience in live format where you can, see someone, almost touch them. And, you know, what we're doing right now, which is a wonderful thing between the three of us, and then the sense that there's trees coming to life out there, so I make a huge distinction, just a personal one, that I've enjoyed both of those kinds of things. I love it when someone, comes up and says, "Oh, I heard that interview," for example, with Dr. Joe, talking about marijuana, should it be legalized back in the day? And did we have a way to measure someone's, sobriety, not sobriety, but their incapacitation if they're behind the wheel? And, we hadn't done the testing, but the people are going to vote a certain way. And they did. And there we go. So, these are kinds of conversations that people, I think, are grateful to have. And there's nothing like the thrill, as you talk about it, for the Drug Story Theater folk, to be there with a real human being and to have them so close. And when you hear that applause and there's a vibration that comes from audience to a person's chest, and it's shaking in there, and you can feel that. That's real. It's different when we're doing what we're doing right now, and beautifully can be wonderful and accomplished, but different. In terms of strict performance, it's nice knowing that you got something right when you feel like, okay, I got this. I know that this is going to work. This past holiday season, a friend of mine at the Boston Symphony, said, "Hey, are you free to do The Night Before Christmas?" I'd done it, half dozen times in my life over the years. I'm living in Rhode Island, and the Pops Keep Locker were going to come to Providence. And I said, "Oh, sure. I'm love to do that." And then he calls me and says, "Oh, guess what? There's a sponsor in Rhode Island, and they're going to have their weather person do it. And, sadly, we know how good you'd be doing this, but that's the way it works." And I said, "Fine." Then he calls me back a few days later and says, "Hey, would you come to Boston?" I said, "Heck yeah, I'd love to do that." And it was an opportunity to bring family and grandchildren to see this. And it's like, I got this. I mean, I've done this before. And I walk in the building and, walk backstage, and there's Keith Locke. He goes, Steve, oh, I didn't know it was going to be you today. This is great." Yeah. And I go, "Do you want to go over anything?" He goes, "Steve, do we need to go over anything? You've done this before." And quite frankly, it's true. And to come out and to know, I know the way that symphony works. I know it with the way The Night Before Christmas is scored, and the way the images are going to appear behind. And I know it's going to be great. And it really doesn't have much to do with me, except that I know how to hit my mark. I know how to give a little bit of juice to it. And it's a pleasure to know the love that's going to happen there. So sometimes we know that's right in an interview too. You're interviewing someone and you say, "Well, tee it up, baby. This person is going to be easy. This person is going to be great." Quite frankly, not to, float your ego too terribly much, but Dr. Joe, the reason that young producers said, "There's been a school shooting. Let's call Dr. Joe. He'll know what to say." And it's true. And then we believe then that we're confident there's going to be a good delivery of service on the topic. Like, well, what do parents feel at home? What do you say to a six-year-old when they're seeing the fact that another school shooting has occurred? Well, there are things that can be said. It ain't easy, and not all parents can do it the same, but here are a few comments and a few encouragements, and you feel a little bit better able to do your job as a mom or dad.
Well, I very much appreciate that, Steve. Appreciate that compliment, and my narcissism is intact, but I will keep my ego intact. So thank you for that. Mark, what do you think about this conversation? I mean, Mark, just, you know, Mark is doing amazing things in the community for so many people. It's the Pan Mass Challenge. I mean, he will ride a bicycle to support other people. He does all these things. Do you get that same feeling, Mark? I mean, you're not up on stage in the same way, but what's it
you
like?
Well, there's the helper's high, right? So that becomes the same oxytocin feeling. But I wanted to ask Steve about the adrenaline, right? The live, the getting ready for it. Are you kind of an adrenaline junkie? Are you always in search of that? Like an oxytocin addict, I guess, would be the best way to describe it.
Today, I would say no, although I value that. And I can anticipate that. So in truth, you know, it was just a thrill to be invited to come back to the Pops, because it does make me feel great. And I know it's going to be great. I'm a change agent in a way, because they've got their act down. They know the way it's going to work, but not all factors, not all contributors are going to be the same. And so I knew that I would get the reaction that I got from the maestro, because we've done this before. And because not all people are created equally, it's like, sometimes it's better than others. Oh my God, it's Steve. I mean, so there's a thrill ego there. In television, the journalism thing was kind of a quiet pleasure in a way, and not a satisfaction of like, oh, I get to be the anchor guy. And people will say, because I really didn't like that at all. I didn't care about that, honestly. But I did certainly thrive on the pleasure of bringing my best effort to the stories of the day, and helping advance people's insight and understanding and awareness about things. And it's something, everything is primal as, did they put out the fire? Did they catch the bad guy? Did the money get returned to the bank? To who got elected? The votes are in. The Red Sox won the World Series. I mean, you know, these are kind of runs, hits, and errors, to use the metaphor, that are a pleasure to be a part of. Like, to be the one on top of that and sharing that's pretty cool. But I don't need to be the guy necessarily. It's much fun to have one of my many friends who are accomplished and award-winning do their job. Getting called by my boss and saying, there is a horrible hurricane. It's in the Gulf. It's coming straight from New Orleans. People are going to die. We need to go cover it. I'm saying, what? From Providence? You want? And he said, he was smart enough, the guy named Joe Abuzed, he was smart enough to say, yes, this is going to affect the country, and we'll have, and it's up to you to find local angles if you can. But to get it, to be privileged with the task of getting in a truck and driving down there and being there for 8 days and telling the story of Katrina, that's a thrill. And I don't care about sleeping in the back of a car without a pillow and not having any food. I mean, because we knew we were doing the most important thing we could be doing. So that is a thrill, I must say.
And bringing that news, that insight into the world. I mean, you call it a change agent, absolutely true. And making the best effort. There's something so powerful about that, and I'm so honored to say that our sponsors are in many ways the same. They are change agents. They do their best effort, and they bring to the world some amazing, amazing things that we can all access. And with that in mind, I would like to take a commercial break, and we'll hear from our own change agents. We'll be right back with Mark Stiles, Stiles Law, and Steve Averson of So Many Things. Barry, take it away. We'll be right back with the Dr. Joe Show.
Hey, folks, welcome back. So any thoughts? Do you listen to other podcasts? Do you see how they do the sponsors? Is there a way that they're utilizing sponsors that you enjoy or you don't enjoy? I listen to Smartless, and I really enjoy how the co-hosts share the voiceover for the product or service. It's really funny for the most part, but it's unique. It's them really endorsing. Does that work? What do you think? And we're back with the Dr. Joe Show with Steve Avison, the master of many. Steve, what have you been up to now lately? What are you working on? What are you doing?
In my life, I'm tackling the stage of life that I'm in by putting to rest the notion of retirement. Mm. And facing the idea of rewirement.
Mm.
I think retirement is something from grandpa's day. And you know, I don't think any of us are really kind of sit down on the couch kind of people. But I do think some of us may reach a point for one reason or another where we don't have to, you know, chase after the dollars and decimal points as aggressively, because either we don't have much time left in this world, or we don't need to because we've got enough money to last. It's all different, and everybody's got a different story. But I think when you get to that point where you aren't, you know, punching the clock or working for a person, then you got to kind of lift up the hood and take a look under the hood and say, well, now I don't really need to be in the fast lane. So let me unplug that. Let me pull out that. Let me, you know, tune up the carburetor slightly differently and see what, if this works. And that's the rewirement part. And why are you doing that? Because you're still going to have purpose. You're still going to be chasing after joy and love and excitement and you know, initiatives that make a difference. I think most people want to do that because we're not sit on the couch people. And so you're obligated to, I think, recognize that that's not easy. You know, I mean, and that's why I say rewirement. You know, it doesn't just, some of us are going to pan you on a platter. Oh, now here's what you get to do with the rest of your life. No, you got to work at it. And I think if you want to really be good at it, it takes calibration and figuring out what's next and how does it work in my family, my neighborhood, wherever I want to be. So that's what I've been doing. It allows me lots of freedom. And I've, you know, I've got a lot of things on my agenda that are meaningful to me. I've been working with police officers at Roger Williams University School of Criminal Justice, where they come in and they've been promoted. They're no longer walking a beat or driving a particular assignment. Now they're the sergeant or the lieutenant, and their jurisdictions will say, well, we want you to get a little bit of retraining, a little up training. And Roger Williams is a great program. And the dean said, we became friends, and he said, would you be willing to teach something? I said, I got nothing for you. I'm not a criminal justice dude. In fact, I'm very proud of the fact that I've managed this far without entangling too much from my childhood. And he said, no, I think you could make a difference if you could. I said, how? And he said, well, these guys, you know, they've been working with their buddies, and now all of a sudden they got to be the boss of their buddies. And that involves a different, you know, angle of communication. And he said, would you at least think about it? Come up with something for me. And so I wrote up some ideas of, you know, for Dr. Joe, kind of a pedagogy of how one might benefit from a communication class. And 5 years later, here we are, you know. So 5-6 times a year, I go and spend a day. And it's been an interesting time, okay? The last 5 or 6 years, we're going through George Floyd, you know, and so many other high-profile issues. And it has put many law enforcement agencies kind of back on their heels. You know, if something happens, doesn't matter if it's 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles away, everybody says, oh, you're the people who do this kind of thing. And that's not the case, of course. There's, you know, 800,000 law enforcement personnel in the country. And I mean, not just the majority, the great majority are into it for the good reason that they had when they're little kids. You know, they want to do good in their neighborhood. And then there's best practices. How can we get better at this? So I think in New England, the jurisdictions that commit to continuing training and upscaling their guys do a good job. And so that's been a fun thing to do among many other things. I'm on boards. I do a little bit of consulting here and there on a variety of different topics. I work at the library. I teach in schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I like fill my schedule in a variety of different ways.
It reminds me of a book that was recommended to me recently that was very impactful. As Dr. Joe knows, I consume all of my information audibly. So I listened to this book, got to the end, and listened to it again.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's called Strength to Strength.
I love that.
And the idea is that you charge up this first curve and you're accumulating and you're achieving and you're in the fast lane, as you say. And then at a certain point, you start to fall down the other side of the curve because your skill set starts to diminish or you start to burn out. So one option is to fall off the curve. The other option is to jump to the next curve. Like, what is that next curve? Is it mentorship? Is it, you know, teaching? Is it consulting? Is it, you know, but that retirement that we all knew so well, I can't see being a part of that, you know, and the whole generation of work hard, do well, go to a good school, get a job, get a pension, go to retire, die, doesn't seem very appealing to the next few gens behind us either.
I think you're right. I think you're spot on. And I think it's a transformative time. There are lots of thoughts I have about how we, you know, coexist in a fruitful way in the culture. One of them has to do with how you tackle this time. That for me, this last stage of time, or the end stage, or whatever you want to call it. And so that's where the rewirement thing comes in. When I encounter kids, though, and I'm at the high school here, I occasionally will substitute teach. I'll take any. I don't care what the.
Love it.
I know what it's murder. It's a tough thing when someone is entitled to be sick and all of a sudden they got to fill a class and for 40, 50, 60 bucks a day. Are you kidding me? I mean, you can't be doing it for the money. The people who are maybe aren't the ones we want doing it, you know? So I love doing it. And to the kids, I say, you know, what's your name? Where are you going? What are you going to do next year? And especially when it's older kids, juniors and seniors. And they say what their thoughts are, you know, and it's an unfair question that we impose on them that like they ought to know. And it's always bothered me. And so I've got an angle on it, which is where I say, well, you know, one thing I know for sure is that when you guys graduate, you're going to go to a place that I went. What? Where's that? They're thinking maybe I'm going to reference Brown University or URI or UMass or something like that. I said, oh, yeah, you're going to go to a very special place. Not everybody goes there, but a lot of people go there. Well, what is it? I said, well, what's your name? And they said, you're Joe, right? And you're Mark, right? Oh, well, you're going to go to the University of Joe. You're going to go to the University of Mark, University of Steve. We are all going to go to the University of me. And that's where you're going to be 24/7 for the rest of your life. Why? Because you're a lifelong learner. You don't have to go to a university or a college necessarily, though you may. You may take time off. You may work on cars. You may hang out with your buddies. You may rally back and do something else. Whatever it is, you know, you're going to be at the University of me. And it's kind of permission to not be perfect, to not know, to not have it down because, you know, your parents, they want you to be well and happy and to make a buck and to get out of the house and whatever it may be. But the University of me permits you to, you know, make a lot of U-turns and to stop at the pit stop for a little bit and maybe take a time off and then rally back because you're always at the University of me. And here we are, you know, talking about rewirement. I think that's part of the deal too. It's like, I'm at the University of Steve, man. Yeah. I'm learning. I'm in this conversation with you guys, you know, it's a treat to hang out with you and to have my brain on fire thinking about you guys and what you're doing each day.
It's such a wonderful concept, Steve, the University of Me. And it's, I mean, it promotes learning, lifelong learning. It doesn't need to be academic. It's, I mean, there's always something to learn. There's always something new if you're just open to it. You know, just go back to the retirement. People say, well, you know, are you going to retire? And I say, no, no, my wife's car is fine. The Dunlops and the Goodyears are fine. She doesn't need any new tires. That's the only retirement that I'm going to do. But the rewirement, that's all the time. It really is. It's like, I'm just fascinated by the world. And I mean, that's part of the I am approach. You know, who are we? Why do we do what we do? How are we responding to this world around us? And one of the things I really do want to talk about, because I love this University of Me, but from your experience, there's so much difficulty now with truth. Mm. I mean, how do we incorporate that? If I'm the University of Me and I'm trying to learn about the world, learn about myself, what's going on, do you think, with news these days? Is it different than when you were, you know, there is the anchor?
Sure, absolutely. And I think it's different in an incredibly positive way.
Wow, really?
So we'll allow that to sink in for a minute, folks. I believe that what we are experiencing is enormously positive. Here's why. When our parents and grandparents were consuming things, you had a couple of sources. You know, we had Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley, Peter Jennings, whomever. And that was the truth. You could trust them. And you did. But there was a kind of a putting the responsibility elsewhere. And as we have evolved forward, where all of a sudden we went to 24-hour cable, we had options. And you could watch stuff 24 hours. And when bombs started to drop in Iraq, Desert Storm, I mean, you know, CNN was there live. You could see it. You could choose to watch it or not. That was your choice. And then fast forward to today, where everybody is able to present information, facts, visuals, whatever. I mean, the reason that George Floyd happened is a really complicated issue about police training and that sort of thing. But I mean, the reason we talked about it is because people took their iPhones and they ran the camera and they shared that information. So why do I think that's so much better? I mean, I think if we want to have Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow, grandpa and grandpa, telling us what to think and what's the news, we can have that, or we can accept the responsibility, shoulder the burden of choosing what to listen to and how to consume it. And I think we are infants in that process, but there's never been a better time to be able to be exposed and to gain access to all this great information that's out there. And I think we have to be grown up. We have to put on our big girl and our big boy pants and say, you know what? That's worthwhile. That's not worthwhile. And actually, you guys, I have one little bit that I would offer. It's kind of a new thought. But I have three rules for consuming truth. Okay. Here they are. Number one, if you hear something, one source is enough to be curious. Wow, that's amazing. Whoa, did you hear that? And you might even tell someone else about it if you want to, but I mean, you discuss it with your wife or your partner, whatever. Two, you need two sources, however, if you're going to believe it. Okay, you can hear it, you can see it, you can be fascinated by it, be curious about it, thrill over it, get all giddy about it, but you need a second source before you actually believe that that's Joe Biden speaking, you know, on the phone in New Hampshire, trying to get you to vote one way or another, okay? So do yourself a favor and get a second source. And then this is the real big girl, the big boy pants thing. Three sources before you share it. Okay. So one source to be curious, two sources to believe, and three sources to share. You can believe it with all your heart. And you may, and those two sources may be bedrock as far as you're concerned, but do yourself and the world a favor. Get a third source and be really positive that that is a fact before you broadcast it and put it on and try to get people to click onto your, you know, TikTok or your Facebook or your Snapchat, what the heck you're doing, because, you know, there's no limit to the number of people who are not doing those things. And that's a difference between information, just information and journalism, or opinions and journalism, or entertainment and journalism. You know, I mean, I love a lot of these folks out there, and I just say, what a good entertainer that person is, but they're not a journalist. Yeah. And I'm getting political here, but because I worked with Peter Jennings, I cared about it when he died. Tom Brokaw, I think, had retired, and Dan Brokaw had stepped down for whatever reason. And when Jennings died, the week after he died, Rush Limbaugh began a promo campaign, just maybe coincidentally, I don't know, but he began a campaign that was Rush Limbaugh. You remember, at first he was the mouth that roared. At this point, he became America's anchor man. And I remember saying, oh man, come on, dude, you are amazing in so many ways. You're entertaining, you're opinionated, you're edgy, but don't call yourself America's anchor man. That's what other people do. You don't do that. And yet it muddied the waters. And we have to step up and, I think, own the responsibility to recognize facts for what they are and recognize journalism for what it is, and to, you know, put the proper facts and stories into our, put those are the things we got to believe, I think.
I think that's such a wonderful reframe these days, because people are so angry with the news. And, you know, if it doesn't resonate with what your belief is, then somehow it's wrong, as opposed to being able to wonder, why do other people think that? Why are they believing that? I mean, I'm much more interested in their motivation. And that's, you know, that's part of why we have sponsors, is because they have a motivation. It's absolutely true. And I think we should hear from them. Let's hear their motivation and their angle. And we're going to be back with some fascinating discussion with Steve Avison. Mark Stiles will be here too. Let's take it away for the Dr. Joe Show. One more commercial, and we'll be right back.
Hey, welcome back. And again, we're super grateful for you listening to the Dr. Joe Show. If you have anyone that you think might be a good sponsor, shoot us an email at drjoepodcast@gmail.com. drjoepodcast@gmail.com. Give us your thoughts about the show too. We're wondering, are we talking to the trees, or are people really gaining value in this? Please let us know. Thank you again, and enjoy the rest of the show. And we're back with the Dr. Joe Show with Steve Avison, talking about how to consume truth right now. And I want to remind our listeners that everything that is spoken on the Dr. Joe Show is always true. It's just a reminder.
Thanks for the reminder, Mark.
And facts. And only is, facts here on the Dr. Joe
right,
Show.
What Mark said is true.
That's so, Steve, the truth.
Yeah. What about this? It's been a fascinating conversation. Mark, do you want to just reiterate a little bit about where we're going to take Steve next on this, where he's going to bring us in his knowledge and to the best practice? What?
The best practice of what? What are you asking?
Well, we're talking about the University of Me, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about truth. We've talked about rewirement versus retirement. But one of the other things that I know you're interested in, Steve, is the best practice for spouses, neighbors, and town hall meetings. Tell us about that. Best practice for what?
Well, it might relate to the world. You can tell me about this, you guys, actually. It may relate to, or it may interface a little bit with the I am, as I see it, in our world today, where, you know, people are most comfortable being away from the cacophony of conflict and that doesn't mean going to sleep. It doesn't mean sticking your head in the sand, but it means maybe being in your, you know, your foxhole with the echo chamber of the people who, you know, think the way you do and feel the way you do and talk the way you do. And so I think if you creep out of the foxhole, if you brave enough to do that or intentional enough to do that, you should still have your wits about you and a little bit of body armor on so that you can, you know, deflect the things that may come at you and yet still stand there and be in the middle, be ready to engage in an open way. You know, I've got my own little strategies for doing that, because the only way we're going to ever move forward together, arm in arm, absent, you know, an asteroid coming to clobber the planet or aliens with some odd weapons coming, and that'll unify us really quick, I suppose.
Yes.
But how do we do it otherwise? How do we do it for the greater good or whatever? And you know, so my guts, whether it's a town hall or your spouse or a neighbor, is to be really good at understanding what your role is in this moment. Mm. What's your job? Is your job to just listen, you know, to just, because the other person doesn't want your advice, they don't want a hug? Or if you do that, if you come prepared to just be there and find your way, I think you'll get faster to, progress of some sort, the progress you may want, the Steve want, what do you call that, Dr. Joe? What is the I want or the I me or the,
I see domain. So yeah. How do people see me?
It's yeah. And I mean, I think we all have our needs and our wants. So whether you go to your spouse or the town hall or to a neighbor, you know, you have a little bit of an issue and you got to solve a problem, you know, you got the thing you want, but when you come out of the foxhole, I'm suggesting that the listening part is a great place to just be. And it may be that's the only place you go.
Yeah.
Or you may find that all of a sudden someone's asking for your opinion or some help or your advice. This is very helpful for me, Steve, because with my wife, there are times when she does not want my advice. Mm-hmm. You know, what she wants is she wants me to listen and really hear her. And she wants to be seen and heard. And the same is true at the town hall. There are going to be a lot of people there jump up and down over an issue. They want to be heard. So if you can listen, that's good. And then they may get an inch closer to saying, so what do you think?
Yeah.
What do you think? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
You know, and then the ultimate thing would be a hug, right? Because we all want a hug, but it may not be the first thing you want to do. It may not be the first thing you're invited to do. So don't start off with that, because right. It may not be welcome or it may not work or then whatever. And I like to keep track of those things. But if I start off by being, you know, committed to endlessly listening, then I might get close to what I want, I think. So,
yeah. And I absolutely agree. I mean, just to go back, it is sad to think that the way people come together is around the conflict with an external enemy, like aliens or something. This is part of who we are as human beings. The reframe of it is that means we want to protect each other and be protected. So we do want to be a group. And what the IM is trying to say is we're one group. It's called humanity. It's not this group and that group. We're one group. We all want the same thing, which is to feel valued by somebody else. And see, what you're talking about is when you're listening, you are actually giving a gift of time and attention and saying, I respect you, I value you, and I'm interested in your point of view. And that leads to the trust that the other person can have to share it. Because they're not going to share it if they think you're going to judge them and stick them into another group. So I absolutely agree. I mean, listening, it's, I mean, I'm a psychiatrist, so, you know, that's what I do. So the downside of it is when psychiatrists are given a chance to talk, we don't stop talking, but for the most part, you know, we're listening, which really gets in many ways to the I am, you know. The I am is saying we're always doing the best we can, but influenced by and responding to four domains. The home domain, no one's going to argue your home has had an influence on who you are. I mean, you were talking about that early on. Your mom said, yeah, go do the circus. That's great. And the social domain, which is the circus, where you're now in the world. And then those two domains outside, then the internal domains, the biological domain of your brain and body, hungry, tired, digesting lunch. And then the I see domain. How do I see myself? How do I think other people see me? And we want the same thing to feel valued. But because these four domains interact, a small change in any of them can have a big effect. We don't need to change everything. Small changes can have big effects. First truth of the I am. So Steve, given what we're talking about tonight, what small change can you recommend to our listeners?
Well, it'll sound, I don't know. I mean, I'm hesitant to ever give advice, but I've been listening to you. Here's one that pleases me, and it gets me what I want, I find. But if I'm happy just doing this particular thing, I feel good about it. And sometimes it gets me even more good, okay? I find out someone's name and I use it to death. Mm. And I'm telling you, we become friends, we become allies, we become, and mostly I'm pleased to just get my brain in the habit of remembering that particular fact. There's nothing that is more meaningful than being seen, being known. I have a daughter. I'm glad for Dr. Joe to know about my daughter Olivia, because she's about to get her doctorate in forensic psychology. She's working at Bellevue Hospital, and she works with prisoners and adolescents.
Wow.
And one day we're walking down the street, and I see this homeless person, and I didn't have a penny, and he asks for some money, and I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have any money. What's your name?" Mm-hmm. And he told me his name, and I said, "My name's Steve. Next time I see you, I hope I'll have a penny." And my daughter said, "You know, Dad, that was a nice tactic. You gave him respect. You didn't have a penny, but you gave him respect." And so but if I'm on the phone or if I'm out with a hardworking service person at the restaurant, I'm going to know their name. I'm going to say hello, goodbye. And, oh, by the way, can you get me this extra thing? And the difference between doing that and not is the difference between the hustle muscle getting employed to get me what I need or want. So anyway, it's a little cliche. I mean, moms and dads have said that for a million years, but I think it's really right on the money.
I think it's great. So the small change, you know, ask someone their name, remember their name, call them by their name. I do that as well. And it is remarkable how somebody they just calm down. Because they feel valued. And that's exactly what we want to do, which gets us really to the second truth of the I am. Because everyone is interested in what you think or feel about them through their IC domain, which has an effect on their biological domain. Because you know, it feels different when you feel respected or disrespected. The second truth of the I am, you control no one, you influence everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You get to choose the kind of influence you want to be. Steve Avison, juggler, circus performer, newsman, change agent. What kind of influence do you want to be?
I want the other to always feel better to be themselves. You know, that's what I want. You know, I'm happy if a person feels seen, if a person, you know, if, I mean, th- this thing we just talked about in terms of the name, when police officers and I work with them and I say, you know, find out, take a moment, find out the person's name and tell them yours. Mm. Then know that you're not a person who's the state trooper, police officer going to arrest me or pull me over. You're Steve or Joe or Mark. And likewise, you've told them, hey, what's your name? Ah, okay. Hey, my sister's name is. You can go down whatever road you want. Once you open up that door, basically we're just saying, hey, we're both here together. Humans, our parents gave us a name. I know yours, you know mine. You know, license registration, take it from there. You know, but that's first. So
it's powerful. You know, I just want to bring it over to Mark for a minute, because Mark has said that he sometimes feels a little guilty because he gets so much joy from helping other people. Mark, how does this resonate with you?
I love the name component. I love acknowledging that, because there is, you could see it light up somebody when you remember their name. And it feels good, right? So Dr. Joe, that's the oxytocin, right? The helper's high. If I can make that person feel valuable, I'm going to also feel valuable. And you know what? Maybe Steve sees me showing that person value, and then the butterfly effect takes off. So those small changes, they have big effects, folks.
They do. At every and any moment in time, you can remind someone of their value. And whenever you remind someone of their value, you increase your own value. And then you feel safer. And that's the world that we can create together. Instead of this world of conflict, where it's one group against another, we can be one group, humanity. We can share simply by calling someone by their real name.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I'm so honored that you've come to share your wisdom with us tonight, and this chat has been lovely. Come back anytime.
Yes.
Anytime. And folks, I'm glad you're listening to the show, and come back next week for the Dr. Joe Show. Steve, thanks so much.
Nice to be with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, everybody.